Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi. You're not going to believe it's snowing.
What?
Yeah. I know.
I think it's going to be 80 degrees here. I'm in Austin. She's back home in Iowa. And our guest today is calling from London, I believe, or at least the UK somewhere. We'll find out more in a minute. Who do we have today, Mom?
Well, I hope I get this right. Ariana.
Neumann.
Neumann. Okay, and this is a fantastic book. The title of the book is When Time Stopped, and about the author, she grew up in Venezuela. She graduated from Tufts University with a dual degree in history and French literature and earned a master's in Spanish and Latin America literature from the New York University and a postgraduate degree in psychology of religion from the University of London. Gosh, she previously worked as a foreign correspondent for Venezuela's The Daily Journal, and her writing also appeared in The European. She currently lives in London with her family. When Time Stopped is her first book. So, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
And you are in London today, correct?
I'm in London, and it's not snowing, and it's not 70 degrees either. It's somewhere in about 45, and it's just grey and cloudy, so it's London for you, really.
Well, I just heard, I had a friend who was all set for a family trip to London this morning. He was flying from Iowa. His sister was flying from Nevada. His parents were flying out of Florida. The parents got as far as New York, but they found out today there was a big spike in coronavirus cases in London, like yesterday.
Yes, I think the whole of Europe is just
on lockdown, basically.
It is on lockdown. It's incredibly sad, but I think we're going to be on lockdown for a few months. I was actually meant to travel to LA. On Saturday, next Saturday, and I've had to postpone that as well. So I think it's just not in the cards for a bit.
Well, it almost seems like you could write another book called When Time Stopped about today.
Yes, I think.
Yeah, right.
when time and all airlines stop flying.
Oh, my. I'm in a similar situation. I was supposed to go to Mexico on business in a week. Haven't officially canceled, but we're probably not going to go. But then I was, from there, was going back to Iowa. So now how do I get from Texas back to Iowa? I could drive. I have a car here. I can keep a car in both locations. And I'm thinking it might be time for a road trip.
I mean, road trips are wonderful, aren't they? It's sort of, there's a whole book written about them.
Yes, exactly. So, Ariana, tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book.
So I have to tell you, it didn't start off as a book. I always wanted to write. So when I was a little girl, I wanted to be a detective and I wanted to be a writer. So this is great because I'm now middle-aged and I've managed to do what I really always wanted to do. But it didn't start off as a book. It started off as a personal journey. I wanted to solve the mystery of my father. So I grew up, and ever since I was a little girl, I knew there was something strange about my father. He was very, very mysterious. He never spoke about the past. And all I knew about him was that he had been born in the Czech Republic and that he had emigrated with his brother in 1949. So I had no idea what he had left behind. And he never spoke about any family or about his life in Prague before he came to Venezuela. So I really just wanted to solve his mystery and find out why he didn't talk about these things. And at the same time, I wanted to explore my roots. I think when you start having kids and you start thinking about what it is you're going to pass on to them, often you look back at where you come from and get what you're going to pass on from there. And I didn't really know where I came from. So I figured I should investigate a little. So it started as a journey of discovery, and I just wanted to do it for me and for my kids. And that's how it started. And as I started piecing everything together and amassing documents and talking to people, these rather beautiful stories emerged, stories that I felt, because of the people that had lived through them had died, if their children hadn't told me their stories, I think the stories would have just disappeared. And all of a sudden, those stories, I just took an importance of their own, and I thought I should tell them. So I guess that's how it became a book, really. And so it I've been researching it for, well, pretty much for all my life, but really full time for about 10 years. And it wasn't really a book until about 2.5 years ago.
Wow.
So to start off, I didn't sort of go, okay, I'm going to write this incredible story of my family. It was more like, I just need to find out where I come from. And as I did that, this remarkable story of my father's survival emerged, but also these other rather beautiful stories about people that I had never, that were part of my family that had never been mentioned to me.
One thing that is really amazing is how many documents survived.
I know. I've been incredibly lucky. I really have a treasure trove. I have hundreds and hundreds of documents. And as I knocked on people's doors, they all seem to keep documents and keep, recorded stories. So a lot of people had not only kept their papers and their documents and the letters. So I, for example, had family. So my own father was quite pedantic and kept a lot of his papers. My uncle as well kept a lot of letters and a lot of papers. And then as I found other members of the family, so I traced these cousins in California, one of them who lives in San Diego, actually also his father had collected stamps, and he had kept the stamp collection. And of course, those stamps were attached to envelopes, and inside those envelopes were letters. So I got hundreds of letters from my cousin.
Yeah.
And wonderful. And everybody seemed to keep, documents and people that lived through this time and helped my family often wrote down their memoirs, and their children kept these little bits of writing. So I've been really incredibly lucky to have all this, all this documentation. And I trained as a historian. So I was, as I was piecing it together, and I was really just piecing it together for myself, I realized, wow, I do have a treasure trove of historical documents that people might be interested in reading one day.
And your father's story is unusual. It's not just the normal persecuted Jew goes into hiding. There was a little bit of a twist to it, wasn't there?
Yeah.
A lot of a twist.
It's a huge twist.
Hiding in plain sight. Yeah, hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, I think you have to be 22, and you have to be a little bit of a prankster, and you have to be a risk taker, because, God knows I wouldn't do anything like that. I'm in my 40s, I have a family, I'm serious. I don't do crazy stuff. If I had ever been in that horrific situation that he was in. But he was 22. His entire family had been deported to concentration camps, everyone aside from his brother. And he had letters that had been snuck out of the concentration camps, letters from his parents saying, you have to do whatever you can do to stay safe, but you must avoid coming here. So he knew that. And I suppose a lot of people went into hiding and didn't show up to the transports to the camps. So that wasn't so unusual. But people tended to run away from the Nazi empire. They tended to go south via Italy or via Africa or east or west. But what my father did was rather astonishing. He decided that the last place they would look for him would be in the center of it all. So if he traveled from Prague, where he was living, and indeed where he was hiding, because he had absconded from a transport and he was wanted by the Gestapo, he figured that if he went and hid in Berlin, no one would look for him there, because no one would expect to go hide with all the Nazis in the middle of it all in Berlin. So that's exactly what he did. And there's a Czech saying, which is, I think, really rather beautiful, which goes, I don't speak Czech, but I'm told it's something like the darkest shadow is just beneath the candle. So if you're going to hide anywhere, you don't hide in the periphery where the light is going to illuminate you and give you up. What you do is you go to the center of it all. You go just beneath the candle where the shadow is at its darkest, in the very center of it all. And no one's going to look for you there. And you will hide in the shadow. And that's indeed what he did. He didn't hide in the shadow. He decided, he pretended to be someone else entirely. And he pretended to be just a regular Czech guy who wasn't Jewish, who was working for this factory in Berlin, like many other Czechs had been forced to do. And that's how he survived the war for 2 years, because, of course, no one expected a Jew to, well, to do that, to be crazy enough.
The other thing about this story that was really heartwarming, even while it's tragic, is how many of their your family's non-Jewish friends were willing to put their lives on the line to help.
Oh, that was beautiful. You see, I mean, it's, someone asked me the other day, he said, how did you have the courage to, you know, delve into all this darkness? And I said, you know, actually, because it wasn't so dark. You sometimes fear going into things because you think they're going to be dark. And then you go in and you see these little glimmers of light. And actually, that was exactly what happened to me. Not only did I get glimmers of light and of beauty in my grandparents' letters as I read them, but there were all these people around my family. So my family, they were persecuted Jews. They didn't really, they had two choices, if that. You either went and did what you were meant to be doing, and you either went to the camps, or you tried to fight it off. But you couldn't really do anything else. And people around them, though, had a choice. And the non-Jews, you know, could have easily gone, lived absolutely normal lives and not risked anything. And instead, they actually chose actively, a lot of them, to defy the laws and help them. So it was, for example, it was illegal to give a Jew, it was illegal to transport a Jew in a car. It was illegal to give them a cigarette. And this incredibly brave man, so my father lived with his parents and his older brother in Prague, and they had a paint factory. That's what the family did. They had a small paint factory on the outskirts of Prague, and the paint manager, who wasn't Jewish, took this huge risk. So when my father is first told that he has to go and be transported to the concentration camp of Theresienstadt in March 1943, he decides he's not going to go and he's going to hide. And the man who hides him is the manager of the paint factory. And he is this incredibly brave man called Mr. Novak. And Mr. Novak had a family of his own. He had a wife and a daughter. And I've actually managed to find his two daughters now, but one of them was alive during the war and remembers her parents fighting, having these huge, huge screaming fights, because the mother was, understandably, incredibly worried. Mrs. Novak was very worried that Mr. Novak was, you know, harboring and helping a Jew, because he could easily have been killed for that. Mm-hmm. So, and that's exactly what he did. So for 2 months, he built a makeshift wall, a sort of fake wall, and they built a little makeshift room where my father could hide in the paint factory. And he would go at night and help my father out and make sure that he could clean his room and that he had food. And he even went, and a cousin of his was a hairdresser, and he came over and sort of dyed my father's hair a different color, so that if the neighbors spotted someone that looked like my father, they wouldn't recognize him. And he did that for 2 months, and that was incredibly brave. And then there were two other people who were very brave. My father's best friend, who also wasn't Jewish, and he had been posted to Berlin to work in this paint factory. And he was the one that initially, I guess, gave my father the idea that he should go to Berlin. And my father couldn't go to Berlin without a passport. And you could forge ID cards, but you couldn't really forge a passport. And my father's best friend, who looked nothing like my father, was called Stenek. And he lent my father his passport so that he could travel by train from Prague to Berlin in May 1943. And again, this was a huge, huge risk, because if someone found my father with Stenek's passport, Stenek would be in a lot of trouble. So it wouldn't just be my father that would have, you know, been breaking the law, but Stenek as well. And then when he gets to Berlin, my father ships the passport back to Stenek so that Stenek can come and join him in Berlin. And Stenek keeps his secret there for 2 whole years. So he was the only one that knew that my father was not really Jan Sebesta, this man, this Czech man who was working for the paint factory, but really a Jew called Hans Neumann, who was wanted by the Gestapo in Prague. And I think my favorite character is this wonderful woman called Stenka. And she is brilliant. So Zdenka was my uncle's fiance. So my father's older brother was in love with, and I think everybody, I mean, I'm in love with her. I think she's gorgeous and beautiful inside and out. And she was independent and she was studying law and she had her own car. And she, again, could have had her pick of any man, I think, in Prague. And she chose to be with my uncle, who was Jewish. And she not only chose to be with him, but she chose to marry him. And she chose to help the family. So as the war began and all these terrible laws were passed and the family couldn't move around and the family was deprived of all their belongings and couldn't really afford to eat, she would go around and take them food and courier letters around. And then once they were deported to the camps, she was absolutely instrumental in sorting out these parcels of food and supplies that were snuck into the camps to my grandparents. And she went even further than that. So the other thing she did is she went and snuck into the camp.
And how were you able to find out about that?
I traced her daughter. Well, there are two things, really. I have all these letters from my grandparents inside the camp. And one of the letters, and they're coded, but they're very open. But one of the letters specifically very openly said, and it was my grandmother's first letter from the camp. So it's from 1942, and it was at some stage in the summer. And she basically just wrote, I have seen Zdenka, and her visit has brought me so much love and so much hope, and I couldn't believe she's come in. And I thought that made no sense because Zdenka is not Jewish. She wouldn't be inside the camp. So I couldn't quite figure it out, and I thought, you know, how could she? It must be a different Zdenka. What are we talking about? And then I traced Zdenka's daughter. So Zdenka had a daughter after the war. It was very difficult to trace it. And I tell my daughters this all the time. They mustn't change their name when they get married. But, you know, it's very difficult to trace women.
Yes. You can,
because they don't change their names. But if women, if they move from the town that they were born and then they marry someone else and they change their name, it's really difficult. So it took me about 4 years to trace this woman. And I finally traced her. And when I told her who I was, she knew actually much more about my family than I did, which was a bit strange. And she said, oh, look, my mother wrote all these things as she got older and instead had lived a very long life. And I have all these writings for you. They're in German, but I will translate them. And when she translated them, there they were, you know, Zdenka's accounts of sneaking into the concentration camp of Theresienstadt.
Wow. Wow. Now, she and your uncle were married. What happened? They both survived the war.
They both did survive the war. I think the war changed them drastically. And I think if I tell you that I'm giving away one of the biggest secrets.
Okay. Well, let's not do that.
let's just say that they had a turbulent relationship and they had to marry and divorce and marry and divorce. But I firmly believe they were the love of each other's lives. And I think they believed that too. So they
married and then they divorced because it was illegal to be married, but then they remarried because that was the only way to save your wife from being sent away.
So they tried to play the system and so they were married and then they were married in 39 and then they divorced a few months after and then they remarried in 42, and that it, just when there was a little window in the laws that you could do it, and then that saved Lotter from being deported because you being married to a non-Jew meant that you were safe at least until January 45, when he was then placed in a transport. Wow. And she was just absolutely instrumental in keeping the family together, and she was just so full of bravery and courage and love and hope. I think she really was what held, you know, certainly what held Lotter together, my uncle together, and what kept everyone, you know, just afloat during the war.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ariane Neumann, the author of When Time Stopped. So Ariana, you grew up in Venezuela, so I'm assuming you speak Spanish fluently. You obviously speak English fluently. Mm-hmm. And if you have a BA in French literature, you probably speak French fluently, too. are there any other religion or any other languages here?
I speak Italian, but I think if you speak Spanish and French, Italian is cheating, really. It doesn't count as another language. But no, I'm really lucky my parents, actually not my parent, father, I really wanted to learn Czech and my father refused to teach me. But my mom was adamant that I should speak other languages. So when I was a little girl in Venezuela, obviously I grew up speaking Spanish, and a lot of my mother's family spoke French. So she spoke French to me. So that was my second language. And it wasn't until I was about 10 that they sent me to learn English. And then I eventually went to an American high school. So that's, and then I eventually went to American universities. So I now actually feel much more comfortable in English than I do in any language. And my Italian is sort of rudimentary. But I can order pasta and pizza at restaurants. Really.
and say ciao.
Ciao, exactly. and just appear cheerful at all times.
Yes, in Italian. Yes. So. Of course, being in Italy right now is a little scary. My nephew's studying in Rome, and of course the schools are all locked, are all down. They're all shut.
Of course. Yes, I have lots of friends as well in northern Italy. And I think it's a little bit of a ghost town, and it's difficult. But I think, everybody says, it will pass, and then life will return, hopefully, to, as much normal as it can be.
To some sense of normal, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and again, this is, a very different reason, but that was kind of what life was like for your family back then. It was, everything stopped, everything changed, and then eventually it kind of went back to some sense of normal. Mm-hmm. I understand. It's not uncommon for survivors to not talk about it, but your father really kept things much more secretive than a lot of survivors did, I think. Do you have any understanding why?
I think I do. I think now that I'm a mom, I realize that we really have this instinct to protect our children. And you want to protect them not only from, from germs and bullies and all those sort of everyday things, but you also want to protect them from the sadness in life and from the difficulties that people face sometimes. So I think my father didn't speak about it because he didn't want to burden me with his sorrow. I also think it was so traumatic what he lived through that there was really no way that he could have his past and his present joined together. I think when you have severe trauma, there's a sort of breakdown, and you have these, I think we all have a narrative thread that we weave through our lives, and we're able to look back and say, oh yes, I grew up in Venezuela, and then I went to university in Boston, and then I did this, and I have a little thread that I weave through, and I think if I had had a horrendous trauma like my father had, that narrative thread would break and I would have pretty disturbing images, which is what I reckon my father had, that he would put somewhere in the back of his head. And it was, I think, easier for him not to talk about the past at all, because otherwise these sort of terrible broken images and terrible pain would sort of seep its ugly head. And I think he was scared of losing control. And I think he was very effective at becoming someone else. So I think he learned that by going to Berlin and having to be someone else in 1943. I think a lot of what he learned there actually served him very well, really, in his future life, because it's not that he pretended to be someone else completely, but he did block certain bits of his past very effectively.
That was interesting. So
I think, and I think a lot of survivors do that. I think a lot of them, as they approach the ends of their lives, and they soften up a little bit and they start talking more about it. My father did that a tiny little bit, but I mean, literally, sort of, he went from zero to, you know, zero. I think he went from zero to two. So it wasn't a huge, you know, it's not like all of a sudden he started becoming incredibly open. So I don't know. I think it's just too traumatic, and I think it was too traumatic for him to do it. And I also think is, you know, it's just difficult, I suppose, when you're, when you have an engaging life and things are happening, and he was really a very positive, very proactive guy. He wasn't the kind of guy that sort of would sit there and reminisce about, oh, things used to be so wonderful, you know, 50 years ago, or I really miss this, or, you know, he was just always focused on the present, and he was always dreaming about the future. And, you know, he used to read all these magazines called American, what was it, Scientific American. He was just fascinated by the by the present and by the possibilities. So he didn't sort of sit around, you know, regretting things or reminiscing about the past. And I guess, you know, that's just that that's, well, that's who he was, and that's what enabled him to survive. I think if he had been focused on the past, his it would have destroyed him, really.
Now, did you know your uncle Lothar as you were growing up?
A little bit. So I didn't, I wasn't very, I say I wasn't very close to him. He was actually my godfather. So, but he was, my father had me when he was 50, and Lothar was even older. So he was quite an old man by the time I came around. And he, I grew up in Venezuela, and my uncle had moved to Switzerland before I was born. I didn't really have very much to do with him. So I did visit him with my family a couple of times, and he was a very kind, I think I described him as a gentle giant in the book. He was very tall and had sort of enormous hands, and was very kindly and very soft spoken, and you know, again, he certainly never spoke to me about the war, but he died by the time I was, I'm trying to think, I was in my early 20s when he died, and I hadn't seen him very, very much at all. So I would, you know, a couple of times when I was a little girl, I accompanied my parents to visit him. So I did know him, just not as well as I wish I had. And of course, he had daughters who were my cousins. They are my first cousins. But again, they were much older than me. So they're almost 22 and 24 years older than me, I think. So again, I didn't grow up with them. And I think they got a little bit more of the history, a tiny little bit more. But I was speaking actually to my cousin the other day. She came to visit, and she lives in London too. And she was saying, and I said, well, you, of course, knew much more. And she said, I wouldn't say much more. She said, you know, I knew a tiny little bit more, but very, again, very little. And her father too, whenever he spoke about the past, would really get very, very upset. So they actually, you know, they dreaded those moments where their father started speaking about the past. But at least they had those moments where I didn't really.
Now, you haven't or had an older half-brother. He must have known more because he was born kind of not too long after all these events.
You know, it's funny. I don't think he did know much more either. So I think he, and I think this often happens with the children of refugees or children of people that emigrate. So his mother actually had helped my father through the war. So my father had a girlfriend during the war called Mila, and he eventually, after the war in 1945, married Mila. And my half-brother was born in 1947. And by 1949, they had moved to Venezuela. And I really don't think they spoke very much about it. And I was talking to another member of my family the other day, and she was saying that she didn't think my brother Miguel knew very much about what my father had been through during the war. Again, I think they just didn't want to burden him with the details. And I wonder often, because my father and him didn't get along, you know, that they were just very different people. And I wonder if my brother had known, if he wouldn't have been a little bit more perhaps forgiving of my father's, you know, my father could be a bit, I don't know, he could be a bit strict and difficult and distant. And I think if my brother had known what he had gone through, he might have been a little more forgiving, maybe.
That makes sense. Well, Arianna, why don't you read a little bit from When Time Stopped?
Sure, I would love to do that. So I'm going to read a passage which is sort of about halfway, two-thirds into the book. And it's going to combine my voice and then my father's voice as well. So one of the efforts to draw back the curtain on my father's past came when I was in college and we were discussing my career plans. I explained that a creative writing course that I had taken at university had led me to think that I wanted to be a writer. He reacted with his characteristically cool scrutiny, carefully testing my thinking rather than expressing a clear view. And then he did something different. Without a word, he disappeared into his office and returned with a single sheet of paper. I saw that it was a typed page in Spanish, his fourth language. It told the story of a train journey to Berlin. At that point, all I really knew about his experience of the war came from that typed page. A train journey to Berlin, the loss of many lives, and above all, a sense of abject despair. He showed me only that first page and never again raised the subject of the others. A decade later, after his death, I found a clipped bundle of papers at the bottom of the box he left for me. It was a retrospective diary of his escape to Berlin, written in 1991 and 1992. The first page was the one that he had shown me. I now know that my father took the night train to Berlin on May the 3rd, 1943, the Elite 147 train that departed Hebernske station in Prague at 1:44 a.m. and arrived in Berlin nearly 8 hours later at 9:23. In the spring of 2018, I traveled alone along the same route. It takes 4.5 hours today, and there is no longer a night train. Even if there had been, I would not have been brave enough to take it. I bought a ticket for the noon train on a May morning. The tracks trace the same path out of Prague as they did in 1943. To my surprise, as the train finally left the suburbs behind and curled along the wooded banks of the Vltava River to my right, I passed through the town of Lipčice. From the large carriage windows, I could clearly see the roof, balcony, and casements of my grandparents' country house, where my father had spent countless happy childhood summers and weekends. The train then headed north, weaving along the course of the river, and came within a kilometer of Terezin itself before crossing the former Czech border and pushing on to Dresden. And then finally, it reached Berlin. I followed my father's route 75 years after his journey, almost to the day, clutching copies of the papers that he had left me. As I made that pilgrimage, I hoped that the night on which my father traveled was moonless, and that in his fear, he did not notice his parents' house, unlit, as the train rolled onward. That he did not know how very close he was to them in the blackness, just south of Terezin. I hoped that he felt me cradling him, holding his hand across the worlds of time and experience that then and now lay between us. This is what my father wrote about that journey. The train did not illuminate the tracks. The carriages were dark. The dim light of the aisles only allowed you to see the coming shadows, the delineations of figures moving, the shells of bodies slumped. I could hear the sound of the train incessantly rumbling and churning. There were 5 others in my compartment, their faces hidden like mine. The darkness is why I chose this train, this hour. It must have been close to dawn, 4 hours since we had left Prague. Passengers sitting and swaying with the movement of the train, our faces shrouded by our coats that hung from bronze hooks. The others might have slept, but I couldn't. I was too afraid. We were close to the German border now. I still could not believe I was here, on this train. I touched the passport in my left pocket, the one with the permit to cross the border that Zdenka had sourced. In my other, I had the identity card that Mila gave me. We had used a chemical to carefully erase the names and mixed the inks to match the color of the rest of the text. It now read, Jan Sebesta, chemist, born in Altbunslau on March the 11th, 1921. Only the passport had the name Zdenek Tuma. I prayed the identity check would be quick in this compartment, a swift formality. I owed Mila the passport too. She was the one who had finally convinced Zdenek. Things were awful enough. No one wanted to take unnecessary risks. So to have this passport was a miracle. On arrival, I was to post the passport back to Prague so that Zdenek could use it to travel back to Berlin in 3 days. Helping me meant that they were both risking their lives. Zdenek had not wanted to let me down, but he was terrified for his sake and for mine. He was scared that I couldn't pull it off. My main worry was that the photo in Zdenek's passport. Zdenek's face was much thinner and much more angular than mine. His eyes, like clever piercing darts, were unlike my large green ones. You have the dreamy eyes of an artist, my mother had always said. The train stopped. I heard voices that I assumed to be the conductor and the border police. I took the thin glass vial covered in brown rubber from my pocket and placed it at the back of my mouth. I held it between the lower back left molars and the side. I was told it would take only a few seconds, a minute at most. Cyanide poisons your nerves so that the brain dies first, then the heart. Would death be easy, or would I feel unspeakable pain? Passports, a German voice said. They were not asking for other papers, just passports, not the papers with the other name. I took a breath. In the darkened carriage, the handheld beam lit up each passport held by every extended hand. Three men had the light flash in their faces. Two remained obscured under their hanging coats. I pretended to be asleep. The guards shook me. I kept my face hidden beneath the coat, my eyes half closed. My hand moved the coat a few centimeters to show deference and offered him the passport. He looked at it for a few seconds. I was certain that he must be able to see my heart pounding in my chest. Danke schön, mein Herr, he muttered as he closed it and handed it back. I waited a few minutes to make sure they were gone. The train heaved forward and I was able to breathe again. I coughed and spat the ampoule into my hand. I placed it carefully back in my pocket. I would need it again. I slept until we pulled into the station in Berlin. It was mid-morning. I placed the passport in an envelope, which I addressed to Zdenek at the central post office in Prague, and sent it through the Reich Post. If I was caught now, there would be no more danger to Zdenek. The warming sunlight shone in between the buildings as I stepped outside. Suddenly, my briefcase felt very light. It was a beautiful spring day in Berlin in May 1943. The fourth year of the Second World War. Berlin. There I was, now Jan Sebesta, a Czech chemist looking for a job and a room to rent.
Thank you, Ariana. That was Ariana Neumann reading from When Time Stopped.
Thank you.
There are two miracles, well, more than that, but you know, the Germans, the Gestapo kept such precise records of everything that it's amazing to me that he was able, they were able to falsify these documents, you know, some of these documents that they did. And that was a miracle. It really was.
It was, yes. I agree.
And also that he was able to post that thing back to Prague, the post office. I mean, that's another miracle, really, when you think about it.
I know. I mean, it's just incredible that, you know, you could just post back the passport and no one would open it. But I suppose, you know, that it was, I mean, he was just incredibly, incredibly lucky. And there were other moments, too. I mean, there was one moment where his boss, his boss in Berlin decides that he's going to ask Prague if this man has a criminal, if Jan Sebesta has a criminal record. And you know, my father is just absolutely terrified because he reckons, okay, they're going to ask Prague if this man has a terrible record. And someone's going to come in and say, well, no, this man doesn't have a record because this man doesn't exist. Of course, they never check if he exists. They only check what they're told to check. And he always said that he was saved. And he had said this to other people, too, that his life in the war was saved by the Nazis' lack of imagination. Because exactly the question that they were told to ask, which was, does Jan Sebesta have a criminal record? And of course, the answer came back as no, he doesn't have a criminal record. Because, of course, he didn't exist. But no one thought to ask, is there a Jan Sebesta in the records at all? Because if they had that, then they would have known that there had been no Jan Sebesta from Alt Bunzlau, born in March 1921, because that person was made up. So it was really, I mean, he was insanely lucky. And it was a very bold and brave thing to do, to go to Berlin. But, you know, luck was also on his side. And so it wasn't just that he fooled them. He was just incredibly lucky.
So, Arianna, as you had gathered all this information and you were searching for family history and you were finding out more and more, and the point in time came when you realized there was a book, mm-hmm. How did you decide what to put in and what to leave out?
Oh, that was heartbreaking. So my book really should have been about 2,000 pages.
But then nobody would read it.
But no one would read it, exactly. So you have to be, and it was difficult because actually the book to me was about all these stories that I uncovered, and ignore the book, but the journey for me was about all these beautiful stories. And I, you know, my father had a huge family, so it wasn't just my grandparents and the two of them, but my grandfather was one of eight and my grandmother was one of four. And all these people that I traced, the ones that survived and the ones that I didn't survive, they still had beautiful stories. I couldn't tell them all because there would have been too many characters. And, you know, annoyingly, they all had really confusing names. Sort of, I remember my editor at Scribner going, you know, are they really called Zdenka and Zdenek, the other two main characters?
And both start with Z.
Well, yeah, no. And there's literally, I mean, it's, you know, one has an A and one doesn't have an A. But that's, I mean, it's and they're hard to pronounce. And it's the problem with nonfiction. Right. So on the one hand, you just can't change things. And so, what, you know, the story of my father was obviously the key part. And I tell some stories of some of his cousins, because I think that helps illustrate, especially at the beginning, it helps illustrate. But it helps illustrate the anxiety and the reasons why my father decided not to go to a camp. So one of his cousins, for example, was killed as early as 1941 for swimming in a part of the river that was forbidden to Jews. So, you know, my father already knew, I think, at that stage that you just couldn't trust these people to do what they were saying they were going to do, because, you know, they killed a young, fit man in 17 days for just literally going for a swim on one hot September day. So his story I tell, but there's a lot of other wonderful stories that I just couldn't. I sometimes think maybe I should do a sort of one time stop too. but you know, I do. And I have put all the stories together, and they are going to go in a separate book, which I don't think anyone's going to publish, but that I'm going to bind together for my cousins, because it's just nice to have the whole family story in one place. But I you know, I focused on my father because actually, I suppose, really, you know, the mystery that I wanted to solve as a child detective in Venezuela and that I wanted to solve all my life was really the mystery of my father. And then I talk a lot about my grandparents, again, because they shaped who my father was. And because one of the most beautiful parts of this research was really getting to know these grandparents that I never met, that were never spoken about. And it's not that they were forgotten, really, but they were just sort of veiled in silence. So to discover them was really beautiful. So I'm very lucky that Scribner said I could talk about them a little bit, and I could talk about them in the camps. but it's always very difficult when you, you know, when you discover this whole wonderful, vibrant, loving family to realize that, you know, you have to make it readable and interesting and gripping enough that it's not just any other family memoir.
Now, when time stopped, we've talked about the meaning of that, one sense of the meaning of that, but as the title, it has another sense of meaning for your father too.
Well, I think, yes, I think it, he was obsessed with watches, and I couldn't, you know, it was quite, I mean, he was a very obsessive guy and he collected lots of things, but he had 297 watches.
And, oh my goodness.
I know. I mean, there were a lot of watches in my house, and he had this special room at the back of this corridor by the kitchen. It was a windowless room, and he only had keys to it. And he would spend hours whenever he wasn't doing, you know, he was a very successful guy, and he was very engaged in all sorts of things, from business to arts to, you know, he wrote for newspapers. He was engaged in education. He really, and in philanthropy. But whenever he wasn't doing something really exciting and interesting, he was sitting in the dark with a sort of huge magnifying glass and some light shining on the mechanism of a watch. And I once went up to him as a sort of, you know, 9 or 10 year old. And I said to him, you know, what, you know, why the obsession with watches? Why, when, you know, when did it start? When did you start first decide to look inside a watch? And he told me this very strange anecdote, very strange story, which I now, I mean, I'm convinced would have been when he was hiding in Prague in 1943, between March and May, when he actually decides to go to Berlin. He is hidden in this tiny little makeshift room in the paint factory. And the paint factory was working, and there were about 50 employees going in and out. So my father had to sit there, age 22, in this tiny room, in perfect stillness. He couldn't make a sound, and he couldn't, there wasn't very much to do from, you know, when the workers got in there at 8 in the morning until they left at 6. And he explained to me that at some stage in his life, and he didn't specifically tell me it was, you know, when I was hiding, because of course he didn't talk about that, but he said there was a moment in my life where I thought time had stopped, and I felt exhilarated by the sense of freedom that, you know, no time, there was no time. But then I thought, oh my goodness, I'm never going to be able to go back. And it terrified me. And I took apart a watch because I thought maybe I was going crazy. And even though I could hear the tick tock of the watch, I didn't really believe it. I thought maybe that was in my head. So I took apart a watch and I looked at the mechanism, and I found great comfort in seeing the wheels and the pivots of the watch move. And that's when I knew that time was indeed passing, because I had been very scared that time had stopped. And I think that's where his obsession with watches comes from, that moment there. And I think in many ways, time did stop for him, because, you know, whenever his narrative broke at that moment. And I, you know, I think it stopped then. I think it stopped when he found out what happened to his parents. I think there are lots of moments in the book where time literally stops. And I think the other thing that I try to do is I also try to make time stop, not because I was so traumatized, but because I thought, if I could actually stop time, not only just stop time, I actually wanted to reverse time. I wanted to go back and really, really understand my father and piece his story together, not only in the, you know, in the 40s, but also so that I could understand him better in the 70s and 80s and 90s, when he was my father. So I think that's the significance of, I don't know, that's probably quite a lot of significance and meaning of the
yes,
title.
Yeah.
But that is sort of where the title, I think, comes from. And it wasn't the original title, but, you know, books never end up with the original title.
What was the original title?
Original title was The Shadow Beneath the Candle, which is the Czech thing.
I knew that. I knew that was going to be
You know, it's funny because I think that title is possibly a little more poetic, but I also think it's very hard. It doesn't stick in people's minds, The Shadow Beneath the Candle. People started calling it all sorts of different things. And I think there's a brilliant writer called Claire Massoud, who teaches at Harvard, and she teaches creative writing at Harvard, and she's written these beautiful books, these fiction books mostly. And she wrote, and she said, you know, I love the book. She wrote this to my editor at Scribner. I love the book, but, you know, the title, I just can't get my head around it. I just keep on forgetting what it's called. And it was interesting. But anyways, the people in the UK, my editor, I ended up having two editors, one in the US and one in the UK. And they're very, very different people. So it was lovely to have them both, because it was, I don't know, they focused on different things. But the one in the UK loved The Shadow Beneath the Candle, and the one in the US wasn't convinced. So when Claire Massoud said that, he just went, I told you so.
So the book has been published, or is being published, in, I believe, 5 countries?
I haven't counted, but I think so. So it's Australia, New Zealand, and it's Australia, New Zealand, and it's being, printed in the UK, printed in the US. It's also coming out in Prague actually next month, and it is also coming out in French.
All right.
Great.
So are you involved at all in the translation?
Do you mean no, so I don't speak Czech. Right. So I'm a little involved in that my Czech translator is asked me a gazillion questions. He's a very, very thorough guy. So and actually my family did some unusual things, not only just hiding in plain sight, but little things like, you know, the sort of the names of the dogs were in English. So my family, who were Czech and lived in Prague, spoke English and had cousins in America. So the dogs had American names. So anyway, so I'm a little involved in that. The sort of translator will sort of write to me and goes, you sure your family's dog pets were called Jerry and Jin? And I was going, yeah. And he said, that's impossible. You know, Czechs don't call their dogs Jerry and Jin. I said, well, you know, these Czechs did. But so I'm involved from that point of view, but I'm not actually translating it myself. I think because I did most of my academic studies in English, I feel very comfortable writing in English. Even though when I get angry at my kids, I scream at them in Spanish. I think it's a much more effective.
And do they understand?
They do. They do. They know all the bad words in Spanish.
I bet.
It worries me a little bit. Actually, my son, I'm hoping my eldest is going to go to the US to study, and we're waiting to hear where he's going to go. But I always think he's going to go to, you know, to an American university. He's going to go and hang out in the sort of Latino house or whatever the Spanish club is called, and all he's going to be able to say is all these, you know, really awful angry Spanish words that his mother says to him when he leaves. I don't know, he's not the tidiest.
Now, this is your first book.
It is.
And although you had done other types of writing, you were a foreign correspondent, so you journalist. Was it difficult to find a publisher?
You know, I was really very lucky. And I pinch myself on a daily basis. I have a lot of friends who I call proper writers who have been writing since they were in their 20s. And they're much better writers than me, and sometimes they struggle to find a publisher. I was very lucky in that I found an agent almost by chance, and she happens to be this just formidable woman in England who is a very well-known agent, and she liked the story. She asked me for some writing, and she liked the way I write, and actually when I went to meet with her, we were wearing exactly the same earrings, which like my earrings, and actually that meant that she took me on literally that day, and she really championed the book. I met her in May 2017, and she said, okay, I didn't have a book then. I had some writing that I had done in my 20s, because I've always written, but I've written as therapy, really. I write whenever something happens to me, I write it down, mostly because I find it very useful. I then can digest it and absorb it and get it out of my system. So I had a little bit of that, and I had actually taken some creative writing courses. And I also showed her, I think, an article or two that I had written. But they were very silly articles. So I worked in the features section of newspapers and magazines. And by September, I had put together a book proposal, which had, I think it had three chapters. It had the prologue and the first three chapters, and it had a chapter summary, and it had a few pages of my research. So, I mean, when I say a few pages, I mean, it was 120 pages of a book proposal. And a long book proposal. It did have some photographs in there. So it wasn't all writing, but I would say about 100 pages were about, you know, to do with writing. And she sold it a couple of months later. So it was very quick. And I'm very, very lucky because, I mean, Scribner is the kind of publisher you dream about, right?
Absolutely. And for a first time book to be sold even on a proposal at all.
Yeah. So I think nonfiction tends to be sold on proposal. If it had been fiction, there's no way they would have ever sold it as a proposal. But no, I'm incredibly, incredibly lucky. And it's still often, I don't quite believe it's a book. I still sometimes go on Goodreads just to make sure that it really is in there. I check my shelves and, you know, and I touch it and I go, wow, it's a book. And it's published by Scribner. Wow. And I'm still pinching myself. And I hope I continue to do that, because it's just that wonderful moment of, you know, that sense of awe that you have that you, something incredible has happened to you. It's just wonderful to, you know, to keep as long as I can. So
now your website says a New York Times bestseller. So has it already made the bestseller list?
So I was, again, really lucky. And it's for a first time book. And so, yes. So the first week that it was out, it hit number 11 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, my God. My goodness.
I think it's out.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's sadly fallen
another,
off.
Another miracle. Another miracle.
Exactly. Yeah. Another miracle. All these miracles. But sadly, it's fallen off. So, you know, just get your readers to go and buy it, and hopefully you'll make it again. But
absolutely.
Apparently, being on the New York Times bestseller list is a bit like, you know, I don't know. It's a bit like being a mom. Once you're a mom, you're always a mom. I think once you get on the New York Times bestseller list, and you know, you're a New York Times bestselling writer. So I'm incredibly, again, very lucky.
Well, Arianna, it's been a real pleasure having you with us today to learn more about When Time Stopped, and we're out of time.
Oh, well, thank
so
you.
So we
very
have to stop.
Thank you. Sorry that I spoke so much.
No, that's what we like our guests to do. And okay. Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
I do. This was is a quote from the book, and it's when she and her father were in Prague. And she says, I tried to catch and hold his gaze while I told him I loved him. I realize now that there are sorrows that cannot be conveyed, wounds with which you learn to live but never completely heal. And I think that's what happened with your father. And I'm just very pleased that he left you all that information so you were able to find out what happened to him.
Oh, so am I. And I actually love that line. So thank you for quoting it. You're the first person to quote it, and it's one of my.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you very much, Monica and Caroline. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.